Welcome to the Tournament Poker Edge podcast, brought to you by TournamentPokerEdge.com, the only podcast dedicated exclusively to poker tournament strategy. Now here's your host, Clayton Fletcher.
Hello once again, everybody, and welcome to the Tournament Poker Edge podcast, sponsored by ACR Poker, where right now we are in the middle of Venom Fever. That's right, the $10 million Venom, one of the biggest poker tournaments in the online poker world, is currently in progress on ACR Poker. It's a $2,650 buy-in. We have satellites running round the clock, so get on to ACR Poker and find out more about it. If you're not yet playing on the site, now is the time. You can click the link in the description of this podcast and join and get a first-time deposit bonus, 100% of your initial deposit, up to $2,000, just by using the promo code TPE. I'm Clayton Fletcher, your host in New York City, and today I am joined by a first-time guest, but a regular listener, a member of Tournament Poker Edge. He's a serious recreational player, a self-described weekend warrior, a family man with a wife and kids who loves to play poker. He's a regular in our Killing Bird home game and in our TPE free rolls. Please welcome to the podcast, Mark Lovin. Mark, how you doing?
I'm doing well, sir. It's good to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, so where are you located? Where are you based?
Live outside of Raleigh in North Carolina, not that far from Derrick, about an hour or so from Derrick. He's to the west of Raleigh. I'm more to the southeast.
Safe to assume that you and Derrick have actually met in person?
A few times, almost always over a beer.
Yeah, that's not a surprise. Well, then you are already in the top 0.1% of all TPE members, because you've actually made in-person contact with our head honcho, Killing Bird. So what was that like for you? The biggest thrill of your life or no?
I mean, definitely a thrill, because I had watched him for a while. I found his stream from this podcast. And, because I found this podcast when you were doing main event hand history reviews and fell in love with the way you do hands. And then you bring Derrick on often enough that once I heard about his stream, I immediately went and found it, became sort of a member of the community, and just enjoy it. It's a really laid-back crew. Derrick's a lot of fun. He's just really, I already used the term laid-back, but he is. He's very relaxed, very easy to hang around, just kind of, and just a good guy all around. So I really did enjoy meeting him, and always enjoy looking, getting out there to the Beagle events or just to have a beer and just to hang out.
Yeah, well, you know, if there's ever been a person that I would describe as laid back, it is my friend Derrick. He's extremely laid back. We got to hang a bit in a fabulous Las Vegas recently when he came out for the tag team event. And by the way, my poor partner, I don't know if I really talked about this at all on the podcast, but my tag team partner didn't get to play a single hand because I busted out before he could even tag in. He's like, why don't you start, Clayton? And I was like, yeah, okay, cool. And, you know, like I flopped the nuts with a pair of eights. Flop came eight high, and I got all in with this guy who had pocket aces. And lost the hands. And then my poor tag team partner, who probably wasn't really planning on coming out for the World Series of Poker, except that he won our free roll and the opportunity to be, you know, my tag team partner in the World Series of Poker tag team event. And then he didn't even get to play a single hand of poker. But we did hang out. We went to Ellis Island, had some barbecue, and I think everybody had a really good time.
That is pretty nasty, for sure. My question is, can he say he played a World Series event? Does that count?
Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose so. He was certainly registered for one. He has a receipt showing that he bought into one. But
that's something for the scrapbook, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I felt really bad. And then, of course, Pocket 8. Somebody commented in the TPE Discord that pocket eights were a cursed hand for me this summer, because it was also the hand that kind of killed my main event run. Pocket eights again, I flopped a set and lost. So I'm okay if I don't see pocket eights for a while. Do you have a hand that
you kind of dread seeing because you know you have to play it, but you have had bad luck with it over the years?
I wouldn't say bad luck overall, but when I'm deep, when you're in the first couple of stages of a tournament and you have like 200 something bigs and you look down at two aces under the gun, you just like roll your eyes a little because there's just like you're going to be out of position to a couple of players and just so many things can go wrong and you're almost walking on eggshells with them.
Yeah.
I feel like at least.
Well, of course, in Super System, the original poker Bible, Doyle Brunson writes that pocket aces are a good hand to either win a small pot with or lose a big one. And I think that's well said. Yeah.
I mean, so. It does seem that way. Yeah, generally speaking, when you're getting a ton of action on the 10-5 deuce rainbow board and your opponent's not terrible, there's a chance you're in trouble, but I don't know. Like that's just my, I guess that's me seeing monsters under the bed. For sure.
Yeah, for sure. So you are a self-described weekend warrior, a serious recreational player. So how much poker are you playing and what do you typically play?
So I mostly play home games around the area because the closest casino to me is actually National Harbor. I'm about 5 hours from Cherokee, and if the circuit's not in Cherokee, I've been told it's not worth going to. It's great during the circuit, but pretty much otherwise you don't bother with it. MGM National Harbor is nice, but it's 4.5 hours away. So when I play, it's generally in a home game or it's on ACR. I've never got into the apps, the Poker Bros stuff too hard. I didn't enjoy them very much, but the live games here are good. I do fairly well on average, even with the high rake in these local home games, because it's generally a lot of players who want to come out and have a couple of beers and socialize and enjoy playing the game. And if you take it seriously and stay focused, you can generally beat them for a decent amount. But then, aside from ACR and live games, that's about all I get to do most of the time, unfortunately.
Now, when you say home games, are these people that you know, or is it like you go to somebody's house and you pay a rake, or how does it work exactly?
The home games around here are someone's house. Someone like has two tables in their garage, and they take to 1-2 game, and they're like 10% max 8 or something, and which sounds like a lot compared to a casino, but again, the action's generally pretty good. It's very loose passive, and you can do pretty well if you study and you apply proper strategy. But yeah, it's generally someone who's running like a small business out of the garage. Most of the games are like that.
Got it. There's a whole underground world here in New York where, of course, Brian Koppelman made it famous with his, I think, amazing movie, Rounders. Actually, gambling is illegal in New York, technically speaking. But yeah, lots of people, they take it upon themselves to turn the, let's say like their warehouse in the garment district into a erstwhile casino in the middle of the night. And yeah, they make a decent side income from that. But typically the rake is absolutely unbelievably high.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, I don't like to play in those games for that reason. Although when I have set foot in such places, the action, as you say, is very good, but if you're taking $25 out of every pot, and sometimes the dealer doesn't really know how much you took, just a handful of chips and throw them into the well, and like, what are you gonna do? I mean, there's no eye in the sky to look back and see what he did. So I don't know. I just tend to shy away, and I prefer to do most of my gambling in Vegas or Florida or wherever I end up going on the road for comedy, but. Yeah, so you end up playing with people that also know about this, entrepreneur's garage home game, but you don't really know the other players. So it's not a home game in the sense of, like, you and your buddies playing cards.
Yeah, it's not like that. No, I mean, I know a lot of the regulars, and we're on a first-name basis, but we're not friends, We're just, right. Like, people that meet at the card table. We're all social. It's generally a pretty good environment. Pretty laid back. No one really gets too angry. It's if you take a beating, you lose 400. It's just not a big deal. But if you, generally speaking, in a high rake game, if you play a tighter pre-flop strategy, you can dodge the worst effects of the rake. You just can't splash around too much. And then it works pretty well in these games. They don't tend to pay a lot of attention if you haven't played many hands, and you can do okay. Playing a very, very simple, boring sort of strategy. But I've grinded out a decent amount of money just doing that over the years.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And you're right, it is boring. I mean, when you have to have it in order to profit, because bluffing is just not profitable in certain types of games, and it sounds like these North Carolina home games might be in that category. You really do have to have it, and as we all know, you can go for hours without really picking up any playable hands, and that can be pretty painful. So what are your tips for people who might struggle with maintaining their patience through such a dry spell?
Oh man, I have learned, honestly, when I first learned this game back in like 05 or something, I actually believed when I first learned the game that you were supposed to win money at showdown. So I learned the game by treating it as a, we're going to make hands and then we're going to bet them. And so like that gave me a decent amount of I know that sounds very fishy, but that's what I believed you were supposed to do in 2005. And in the game when no one folded, that was actually a reasonable strategy. I accidentally had a good strategy in 2005. But nowadays, when you've been card dead, it's difficult. After a few hours, if I haven't played a hand for 3 hours, I will often just realize my patience is leaving me, and I'll just rack up and go home. Because it's better to just quit. If you don't have the discipline, if you decide that you need to leave, and if you don't have the discipline, you decide that you just can't sit there and keep folding without spewing, you probably should just rack up and go. If as far as techniques to get through a card dead run, maybe possibly looking for squeeze spots that might work, but that's only if the players will actually fold. In these games I play in, there's not a lot of folding to three bets even. So you play your big hands hard, but if you don't see a hand for 3 hours, you just sort of resign yourself to not playing. I don't have a good technique in terms of how to deal with that, because that's tough on everyone. It's just hard for everybody to not play for 3 hours.
I think leaving is a great idea. Yeah. You know, like if somebody raises, you're playing 1-2, right? Somebody raises to like $10 and two people call and you're sitting there in the small blind and Jack 8 offsuit starts to look pretty good. You know, that might be an indication that you know that that hand is a junk hand that shouldn't be in your calling range, especially not from that position. If you're at all tempted, it might be just time to go do something else, either get back in the car and go home or maybe go see a movie. You know, movies are expensive, but they're not as expensive as playing poker poorly.
Agreed. And yeah, for sure. I definitely left early because I had zero hands, or, you know, the one or two hands I was dealt got cracked. You know, we've all had those nights. It's not, you know, it's how it is. But definitely being able to rack up and leave. One of the beauties of being able of playing as a recreational player is that I don't have to worry about, I don't have to put my hours in. I want to, I enjoy it, but if I have a bad night, I can just not worry about it. If I'm card dead for 2 hours, I can just not worry about it, and it's okay. I do try to study as much as I can and understand the variance and just stay disciplined that way. But yeah, sometimes I do just, I call it early. Sometimes it's not a good night and I can feel the control slipping away, so I just leave.
Yeah,
and I recommend others do that for sure as well.
Now the other extreme, what I try to do is maybe make the table more engaging, try to get people talking, because if I'm not having interesting poker, maybe I can at least have an interesting conversation. A few years ago in the WSOP, I had two of my favorite people at my same table, and that was Jackie Burkhart and Jamie Kerstetter. And both of them told the rest of the table that if they're nice to me, I might tell them a joke because I'm a comedian. And I said, well, you have to be really nice to me. As a matter of fact, I have to win a pot. If I win a pot, I will tell everybody a joke.
Nice. That's a good dynamic.
Yeah, yeah. So it just kind of made it more fun. And then, you know, if I bluff somebody, then he might say, well, I don't know, you could be bluffing me, but at least I get to hear a joke if you win the hand. So it actually ended up tilting things in my favor a little bit poker-wise. But, you know, I kind of ran out of street jokes after a while because, you know, I'm obviously not going to try to do my material at the poker table. So I end up just doing, you know, jokes that you may have heard before or, you know, read on the internet or something like that. Just some of my favorites. But yeah, that's another thing you could try to do is actually make the social aspect more important than the poker aspect on those nights when you're just not in good situations very much. Because yeah, No Limit Hold'em, single tabling No Limit Hold'em live can be pretty tedious on those nights when you're at a table where bluffing isn't profitable and maybe like your position at the table doesn't allow you to play that many hands. It's just, you really have to have it. And in those spots, it's, you know, sometimes you just want to pull your hair out. Mm-hmm. And I'll bet for you, you probably, you know, thank God on those days, you know, at least I don't have to rely on this to feed my family. So that is a good thing. What do you do for a living, can I ask?
Absolutely. I'm a clinical trials programmer, which, I mean, it's hard to explain exactly, but the best way to say it is that the data that's generated during clinical trials, during final drug testing, where they actually use the product on humans and check for safety and efficacy, the data, there's a pile of dirty data generated that needs to be cleaned up before it can be properly analyzed, and I'm one of the guys that does that.
So it's like data analysis of clinical trials.
Yeah, data management analysis.
Right, right. Are there any skills that you learn in your regular job that you feel apply especially well to poker? I would think perhaps analyzing the data that might be in your poker tracker or hold'em manager might, you know, be somewhat similar in some ways, right or wrong?
There's different kind of data, so I would have to say wrong on that regard. But as far as applying what I do to poker, as a programmer, you definitely have an if A then B else C sort of mindset when you're working on your on what you do, and being able to figure out what's wrong, you know, track down the problem, zero in on what could be causing it. And definitely, you're analyzing your poker data in that regard. There could be some similarities, I suppose. I mean, if I'm having trouble with a certain player, or if I'm having some sort of issue and the cutoff or whatever, I can look at my data and sort of narrow down like where I think the problem is, and generally I'll turn to someone like Alex Fitzgerald or someone like that if I need help with that, because someone who actually knows how to analyze poker data better can certainly help me through rough spots with that. But generally speaking, when you're a programmer, you just think in very simple logical terms, and that sort of mindset can help in poker a lot. Removing your emotions from poker is very important, and being able just to analyze it in a very cold, analytical sort of way, I've found works for me very well.
Yeah, that's great. That's well said. And I can see where your background would help you to be able to do that. I mean, we all want the data to tell us this or that, right? Just as I'm sure any drug company wants to be able to say, you know, very side effects were extremely rare and in 99.9% of cases very mild, right? They want to be able to say that. They want that to be the outcome, but the data actually has to back that up, or else they open themselves up to all sorts of legal problems and possibly being responsible for somebody's death. So I'm sure some drug companies care about that part.
Oh, absolutely. They all do. I mean, the regulations that we have to go through and abide by are it's a very tall stack of rules by which these things are run, and no one messes around with the regulations. When an audit is done, if something's out of whack, people get fired. So we don't mess with that stuff. We play by the rules here.
Yeah, I love it. All right, well, I know you said that you had a hand that you wanted to talk about. I know everyone's excited to hear you know, what the hand is. Is it on ACR? Is it something you played live? Or where does this hand come from?
This hand is coming from the World Series of Poker 10K main event.
Nice. And so did you make it to Vegas this summer?
Yes. This past summer, I just, I guess we're still in the summer, I did play my first main. It was something it was a bucket list thing. It was something I wanted to do. And I was able to make it work this year. So I did. I flew out, played the Colossus, played the mini main, kind of as warm ups, and a few other events around town. But then I played day 1C.
All right. And, so this is exciting. Before we get into the hand, for how long had you been dreaming of taking this off of your bucket list, or someday finally making your debut in the main event? How long had that been something that you really wanted to do?
Upwards of 20 years, because I first got into poker, really got pulled in by David Williams finishing second. When Moneymaker won in 03, I actually didn't notice. I was a competitive Magic the Gathering player first. But David Williams was a pro Magic player, and when he finished second to Raymer, that's when I noticed. And I'd already seen Rounders. Rounders made its way through the Magic community like in 2000 or something. And I thought maybe poker looked cool, but I didn't know, you know, where to play or, you know, anything about it. But when David Williams won, I started playing bar poker, and then a friend invited me to like a 10-cent, 25-cent game, and you know, we've sort of worked our way up from there. But since 04, since I saw David Williams for a second, that was sort of my introduction to this high stakes thing, and I've been sort of wanting to do it since then.
So when you were watching David Williams, did you already know who he was from Magic?
Yeah, David Williams was a Magic. David Williams was a Magic player first, and I followed. He made Magic Worlds, the top eight in Magic Worlds, in like 2000, and I knew who he was years before he came out in poker. I mean, I actually met Justin Bonomo in the finals of a local tournament in High Point, North Carolina, a Magic tournament like years before he came out in poker. So a lot of these guys were Magic players first: Isaac Haxton, Eric Froelich, a bunch of others.
Yeah, and don't forget Elky.
Nope, Elky too. I didn't know Elky, but yes, he's one of many. There's a lot you could name. There's many, many, many people you could name.
Yeah, I've never played Magic the Gathering, but it looks like a lot of the players that were really good at that game also ended up being some of the superstars in poker.
Yeah. A lot of the skills definitely translate. Magic, succinctly, is best described as a combination of chess and poker. There's hidden information, and there's also a board that you make decisions based on, and it's a combination of the two, and it's really an elegant game. I recommend it to people, except the learning curve is so high, and it's actually pretty expensive to play. But I do believe it's a very good game. So,
is there much Magic the Gathering going on in the world now, or is it kind of already peaked?
The problem is I can't tell you that, because I really stopped paying attention years ago.
Right.
But I loved it 20 years ago. These days, with what little time I have, I focus on poker. But I don't know what the state of their organized play is these days. But before COVID, it was great. I can't speak to it now.
Okay. All right, great. So let's hear about a hand that you played in your first ever main event. You picked the right one, by the way. It was a record-breaking main event with over 10,000 players in it. Mm-hmm. So how exciting was that for you to walk in and see all the people and knowing how huge this prize pool was eventually going to be?
A little overwhelming, yeah. But on the upside, I did get my $10,000 card protector, which is very important.
I call it a participation trophy.
Yeah, that's what it felt like, but it's still a nice keepsake. I'm not knocking the keepsake, but this is by far the most I've ever paid for a tournament, so it stung a little.
Yeah. All right, so let's hear about your hand.
Okay, so going into level, so shortly into level five, which is the in the main event, you play five levels a day, with the 300, 600 level on day one, they broke my table, the table I'd been at since the start. And I got moved to a new table, obviously, and two to my right was actually Alec Torelli, the only player I recognized, but I know who Alec is. And I'd studied some of his content, and I knew he was decent for sure. And I wouldn't say that I was gonna try to mix it up with him, but I also wasn't gonna try to avoid him. I came to play, and I came to not just fold into day two. I wanted to actually play well, take the spots as they came, and not be intimidated by it's the main event, it's a 10K. And generally speaking, not let myself get defeated by these external factors that shouldn't matter. It's just a tournament, right? So anyway, Alec, here is the situation. So we are in the low jack. We're the 300, 600 level. We have roughly 75,000 in chips. Alec has us covered, and he is two to our right. He is under the gun plus one. He opens to 1,300, slightly more than a min raise. The player on our right folds, and it's on us in the low jack with pocket eights.
Okay. Well, I mean, this deep, we have over 100 big blinds. You could three bet small, just trying to maybe buy position, get the players on your left to fold so that you could be heads up in position versus Alec holding pocket eights, I think is a totally fine strategy. But it's funny you're bringing up a hand that involves pocket eights, since I already told you how they've been a cursed hand for me. So we have pocket eights. You could also obviously call. The hand plays well multi-way, especially when we flop an eight or a straight draw or anything like that. Obviously if we just call and invite two or three more players to enter the pot, if it comes something like king, queen, deuce, then we're obviously just going to be folding and leaving it to someone with a stronger hand, and or at least the possibility of making a stronger hand on those kind of flops. So I think a mix of three betting and calling is fine. What did you do?
Well, I liked the idea of three betting, but to be honest, when to three bet middle pairs is something I'm still working on learning. And I decided right now was not the time to try to put a move on someone who is a professional, and I don't think anyone would argue who is going to be a much better player than me. So I chose to flat and play position. Ideally, at least have position on him. I don't know what's going to happen behind me, but I chose to just call, keep the pot smaller. Because the smaller the pot is, the higher the SPR is, the more my position is worth. So I chose to call.
I have no problem with that. I think that there's a little bit to be said about not wanting to three bet just because we don't know, you know, how often we should be three betting middle pairs. You know, there is a lot of value in essentially buying the button. Right. So if you just make it a small three bet, like say you make it like 4,000, it's not that many more chips. If that would do the trick often enough of getting everybody on your left to fold, leaving you heads up in position versus Alec, that kind of minimizes his skill edge over you because you're in position with a playable hand. And even if he's a great player, he won't be able to do that much against you from out of position. The downside to me of going with the preflop three bet with this hand is that you don't want to get involved in a, like if somebody four bets small, now you basically have, you're going to be priced in to call, especially with the implied odds of having such a deep stack. And, you know, we just don't want to play too big of a pot with such a marginal hand. So I would be more concerned about somebody, anybody four betting, including Alec. And that would be, to me, an argument for just flatting. But yeah, I mean, as played, I have no problem with just calling and hoping to be able to see a flop for just 1,300 with pocket eights. That's totally fine.
Yeah, and the fact that the table hadn't really been very squeeze happy, definitely I felt like leaning me toward calling. Calling's a little safer now. If there's less of that, you know, let's every time there's a possibility to squeeze, we have to watch out for somebody doing it. Haven't been seeing a lot of that, so that made me a little more comfortable just flatting.
Right.
And
And you won't see a lot of that on day one of the main event. A lot of people enter the main event thinking they just want to make it to day two, and then on day two they just want to make it to day three. So even players who might otherwise be a little bit more aggressive, or as you say, squeeze happy, or at least consider a squeeze, might lean towards just not doing that on day one of the main event. I don't really understand why, because the money doesn't come until the end of day three or early on day four even. So I don't really get it, but this is a philosophy that a lot of people seem to have when they play their first day of the main event. So yeah, but calling is obviously fine, and especially if you're not worried about getting squeezed. Let's just see a flop, and it's okay if more players call, because if you flop an eight, you're going to want them there anyway.
Agreed. And as far as the people, you don't understand people who just want to make day two. There's definitely, when you're a wreck, and I'll be honest, I have at least in part have fallen into this camp, where there's you assign a certain amount of value in still being in the tournament, even if you're not giving yourself the best chance to win. There's some sort of delusional mindset that as long as you're still at the table, you know, it's okay. And it's I can't explain why people think that way. I know that I used to. I certainly am not as bad as I used to be with that regard. But there's something about just still being at the table that matters to a lot of people, especially when they fly to Vegas and they want to stay as they last as long as they could. I don't know why. There's certainly no value in it, as you say, but that is absolutely a mindset for a lot of players. It's almost like they measure the value of the tournament by how long they sat at the table.
Right.
I can't explain why that is, but they definitely do.
Well, if I get my $10,000 worth, if I make it, I last 20 hours instead of 10, then yeah, I guess I got twice as much value.
There you go.
Entertainment
there you go.
Value. I mean, I get that mindset. I really do. And there is value in still having a seat at the table, because once you do not, you are no longer eligible for any of the prizes. So, yeah. Of course, a chip and a chair is worth something, but I think it's grossly overestimated what something is. So, all right, so we're going to see a flop, I guess.
Yes. So, Alec, make it a 1,300 under the gun plus one. I flat in the low jack, and it folds around. So, we are heads up in position, which is good.
Yeah, that's great.
So the flop rolls off, 10 of clubs, deuce of clubs, deuce of spades. We currently have 8 of spades, 8 of hearts. We do not possess a club.
Okay, so it's 10 deuce, deuce with 2 clubs, and we have pocket 8s with no clubs.
Correct.
And I'm sure he c-bets this flop like 100% of the time.
Apparently not, because he checked.
Okay, that's weird. I mean, honestly, that would actually probably put a warning in my mind, if a good player chooses not to bet on 10 deuce deuce, I would actually be worried that the eights were no good, more so than if he put out a standard smallish continuation bet. I mean, it's so hard for you to hit this flop, and so much of your calling range is unpaired hands, suited broadways, suited aces. There just aren't that many hands that you can have that are going to want to continue on this flop. You have one of the few hands that you're going to want to continue with. So the fact that he checks it to me here, I think would actually make me a little bit more on high alert that he's up to something, possibly having flopped a full house or maybe slow playing pocket aces, something like that. It doesn't have to necessarily be the case, but I am concerned right off the bat when a good player doesn't c-bet on a board where pretty much all of us would have. It makes me wonder what's going on.
Yeah, fair enough. That's certainly a fair point. In addition, though, when you're, at least from what I've learned from studying, is that if you raise and get called from someone in position, your c-betting frequency should go down dramatically, especially on dry boards, because you're out of position and you're going to need to protect a decent amount of your range by having a pretty robust checking range, and it being able to cover, all the garbage, having some good stuff in there for sure, like you said. But he's also going to have a lot of ace highs, I would imagine. I would imagine if he has something like pocket, I don't know, maybe smaller pocket pairs, certainly ace highs would probably check. I'm not sure what else. I'm not sure if he's betting all of his flush draws here. It was a little early for me to narrow down his range completely, but the fact that he checked, I wasn't sure what to do about that. I wasn't sure if this was what would he do with ace jack, for example? Ace jack's a pretty good hand to check here and call, because it's probably the best hand most of the time. So what do you do? Do you check or do you bet and try to build a pot? Like, what does ace jack get value from? I don't know. There's a lot of this going through my mind. Because I thought, like I said, that's why I brought this hand to you. I thought it was a really interesting hand to talk about. So
yeah, and that's a good point. That you made a lot of really good points there about having a protected checking range, right? So if he c-bets everything on this flop, then what does it mean when he does check? But I mean, my betting range on this flop versus a player that I perceived to be perhaps a first time WSOP participant would probably be close to 100%. But I do understand the theory behind wanting to have a pretty robust checking range, certainly from out of position when you've been called in position. And I guess a good chunk of your calling range pre-flop is those middle pairs. And obviously they're not folding, at least not yet, not for one bet at this point. So yeah, if he's checking, planning to call, if you bet and he's got something like ace-queen, ace-jack, I'm fine with that. But I think typically when I'm in a situation against a player, I'm assuming that he perceives you to be not a professional. And so then...
I would guess that's true, yes.
Right. So if that's the case, then it kind of takes me back to, well, if you know you can get a non-professional to fold so many hands just by putting out a little c-bet here, you don't actually have to worry too much about protecting your checking range in case the recreational player decides to take a stab just because you checked. You got to be able to check call with ace jack or something. And that's a bit too complicated for day one of the main event versus an unknown
Fair enough.
Entity. So Yeah, I'm kind of back to I'm a little concerned that he's checking rather than c-betting on this board. That doesn't mean that in your shoes I don't think betting makes sense. I mean, I think that in your shoes I would bet my eights, you know, to protect them and possibly to get value from an ace jack that does want to have a check calling range that's well protected. I mean, we are beating all those ace high hands, so let's try to get some value. We can always check behind on the turn if the pot's big enough for our liking after that. So, interesting, but what did you do when he checked?
So the pot's 4,100. I chose to bet 2K, and he called.
I have no problem with this bet at all. I am a little concerned. I don't think I want to keep building the pot. I think that this is about the right size pot for pocket eights in this situation. I am a little bit on high alert, concerned about why the pro didn't c-bet on the 10-deuce-deuce board. But yeah, I think it's fine to bet 2K. I might have gone a little smaller, but I'm not going to quibble with your sizing here. And he calls, so what comes off on the turn?
The turn is the three of spades, which is, I mean, it puts it back to a spade draw in play, but otherwise it's basically a brick.
Okay, so now we have two available flush draws, clubs and spades. Otherwise, we have a pair below top pair and an opponent who checks again, or he doesn't wake up and suddenly bet this card, right?
He did not donk the turn. He checked.
Right, okay. So, yeah, I think here it's a pretty clear check behind. It's pretty hard to get value from much worse. I don't think that if he's got ace jack, for example, since that's the hand we put out as an example earlier, yeah, ace jack isn't going to be calling another bet here on 4th Street. So I think if I bet this turn card and get action, I'm mostly going to be getting action from better hands. So I would just check behind for pot control and to make it easier for me to bluff catch on the river. So yeah, just check behind and see the river.
I'm going to disappoint you here.
Okay.
So I understood that I probably couldn't get any more value from ace high, but I thought that I could still get value potentially from club draws, like, and potentially from a hand like 7s, 6s, 5s, 4s. I don't know if you play those hands that way, but I still felt like the eights were relatively strong here. I mean, I don't think he has an overpair. I honestly don't think he has a 10. I think he would have c-bet the 10 on the flop. I think he would have c-bet jacks, queens, kings, aces. Maybe not, but I at the time, I believe he would. So there, I can't think of a lot of hands that I'm worried about. I don't think he has top pair. I don't think he has an overpair. I mean, I suppose I lose to nines, but I just can't think of... I couldn't think of very much that I was losing to. So I chose to bet again.
Okay, hold on. Let's, before we talk about that, let's just go a little deeper here, because you think you can get value from hands like pocket sevens or a flush draw, and then that takes us back to he has to check those hands to you and not check raise you on the flop of 10 deuce deuce. And I think that's asking a lot. I think that pocket sevens wants to bet this flop so that you don't get a free card with your queen jack or whatever. And I think that flush draws, if they check, they often would check raise, maybe not always, but you know, you're telling me he's going to have like king jack of clubs and just check and call your half pot bet on the flop. I don't know. I think that mostly he's going to be c-betting all of those hands, especially against an opponent that he perceives to be, maybe a first timer or just an unknown opponent. Now, if you replace Mark Lovin with Justin Bonomo, then yeah, I have to check call with a flush draw sometimes. I have to check call with seven sometimes. But I think against unknown opponents, professional players tend to be more straightforward because they're just not as worried about such opponents getting tricky. So it takes me back to, I don't know how many of those flush draws he's going to have in his range, and I don't really buy that you're going to be able to get value from pocket sevens, pocket sixes, because I just don't know if those hands would check and call on the flop. Maybe they would. I could be wrong, but I think that mostly they're going to want to bet for protection. So, yeah, I'm pushing back a little bit, but you know, I'm very curious now to see what happens here on 4th Street. So you bet how much?
So the pot is 8,100, and I chose to bet 3,800, which now that I look at it, it's probably too large. But
okay, because of your value targets being a lot of pairs below eights and possibly flush draws, although flush draws would probably call an even bigger bet, especially a hand like King, Queen of Clubs, right? That hand has so much equity. They might even call a pot size bet. So, I don't know. Generally, our bets on 4th Street are, we want to make them larger.
Yeah.
And generally, on the flop, we want to make them smaller. But I'm not crazy about this sizing because it's kind of too big to be small and too small to be big, if that makes sense.
It's a little confused. In-game, that's definitely something I'm working on, is being able to find the right bet size in-game. It seems easy when you have 3 minutes to stare at the problem and then find the right bet size based on what his range is. But, you know, in game, it's tougher. You have like 10 or 15 seconds before people start getting impatient. And, I think I goofed this sizing a little bit for sure. Maybe betting is entirely bad, as you said, or as you at least suggested. Nonetheless, that is what I did. I bet 3,800, and he just called.
So. Okay. I mean, you know, look, our eights could still be good. He could have some kind of flush draw, like you said, that he's just for whatever reason chosen to play slow. He could have a hand like, I don't know, pocket sevens, pocket sixes. I think it's odd for him to play them this way, but it's certainly not out of the question. And I think that in his shoes, holding a hand like pocket sevens or sixes, I don't think I would fold. I don't know. I don't know. It's especially not for a small bet like that. So
as we've said, it is the main event. He could very well be taking a pot control-y sort of line with something like sevens, sixes, or fives. I don't know how frequently he would do that. I also at least considered. I was thinking that on the flop, he could very well have something like a very good ace high, like an ace king or an ace queen, that would not necessarily fold 10 deuce deuce. So I'm not sure if he would call the turn with those. That's kind of up in the air. Maybe not when some wreck is barreling into him. I don't know. There's a lot of guesses you have to make. You're like, what's his range here? Well, that's a matter of opinion, of course.
You don't really know. Yeah, we never really know anyone's exact range, but exactly. I do think that in his shoes, folding ace king on the turn is correct. And probably what he would have done. So I don't know that you can really get much value from a hand like ace king that doesn't have a flush draw. You might end up getting check raised.
Yeah.
If he did pick, let's say he's got ace king of spades. Yeah. Right? And now the backdoor spades come on the turn and you end up, you know, outplaying yourself because you can't call a check raise, can you?
Nah, probably not. Right. If he had check raised, I would have just folded, unfortunately. And that would have been a great move if he had turned an ace high flush draw, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, there aren't that many. He also could have flopped one and just decided to check call the flop, check raise the turn, and maybe barrel every river.
I do have a blocker to the spade draw, which I guess counts for a tiny bit of something. So.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. Eight of spades, X of spades that he's raising from second position. I don't know how many of those hands there actually are.
9-8, 8-7, and ace-8, I would guess.
Yeah, me too. All right, so what happened next?
So he called the 3,800. We go to the river, which is the 10 of diamonds, which is a very interesting card because it really doesn't change anything. I believe he did not have a 10 on the flop. I thought that he would bet an overpair. I thought he would bet a 10. Because if he has Jack 10, he's probably going to want to get value from 9s, 8s, 7s, 6s, 5s, or club draws. So I would think he would bet there. So I don't think he has a 10. I don't think he has an overpair. I mean, I have the best hand here a lot. I mean, on the river, I really convinced myself he was probably sitting on one of those pocket pairs. It felt like a mid pair that was pot controlling. And when he checked me on the river, I had a decision to make. What do you do here?
Yeah, I mean, this is tough. I mean, I've kind of had like a fear factor all along ever since he didn't c-bet the flop. I've learned in my many years of playing the main event that going for thin value in the main event is not often correct. And that might be surprising hearing me say that, because I consider myself a major advocate for thin value generally. But I think against a known professional player, you know, trying to get him to pay us off again with like pocket sixes here is just asking a lot of the poker gods. I guess I would probably just check behind, kind of scared. Like, I don't know where I'm at. You keep calling me. I'm not going to bet again. So here's my eights. Are they good or not? Just, you know, this pot's plenty big for this hand. I just don't know. I mean, he's probably good enough to fold sixes, even if he does have them. So, at least some of the time. So, I don't know. It's I think that it's kind of dicey trying to get one more call from worse, especially when he calls again on 4th Street. I don't know. I mean, you're right. If he has pocket sevens, he might just be curious enough to call you one more time. But if I were to bet this river, I would bet a very small sizing, maybe like a quarter pot, just to give him 5-1 and see if we can get him to look us up with like pocket sixes or something.
I wasn't sure about betting small on the river. What I mean, again, we're going to go to some theory that I've studied, which is that if you're in position on the river, generally speaking, if you're going to open the betting, it needs to be for a significant amount. Like blocking out of position is fantastic, you know, 10 or 15, 20% of the pot. But in position, betting 20% of the pot and reopening the betting is almost not worth the risk. From what I, again, from what I've learned, I'm not sure if it applies here. There's a ton of that, you know, you study, but you don't always know if you're applying it correctly. There's always that risk.
Well, in Alex's shoes, my amateur opponent has shown tremendous strength by calling from middle position in the first place, my early position open, and now betting into me twice. I'm not sure that I have a check raise bluff in me if you bet small on the river. You should have a 10 a lot when you bet any amount on the end. So I'm not sure I would be overly concerned about that. I do understand why theoretically betting small in position on the end is typically not, you know, a big part of like what a GTO solver strategy would be. But I think in practice, if you say I have to bet here, I just want to bet small because we're trying to get action from such a small swath of hands, pocket sixes, pocket sevens, pocket fours, pocket fives, maybe ace tray of clubs, I guess. I don't know. Like what else can we even hope to get value from? And that's why I think betting at all isn't really worth it in this situation. And that's why I just want to check back.
I can understand that. I had also thought that perhaps it might look like I had a club draw. And if he has something like sixes, fives, fours, sevens, he's probably not going to. I mean, if I can credibly say that I had a flush draw, he may very well have a reason to call. But again, that was in game. I don't know how reasonable it is, but that was the thought process. I believed I had the best hand. If he doesn't have a 10, if he doesn't have an overpair, I really thought I had the best hand here. So I chose to bet because I really thought, well, he's going to show me two sevens, and then I'm going to be a champion. It's going to be great. So I bet 7K into 15.1K.
Okay, so we're still right around half the pot here.
Right around half pot. Again, my sizing is something that's always going to be a work in progress, but that I thought would look like a bluff. Possibly you could believe that a wreck would be bluffing a missed flush draw like that. I thought that was credible. I'm not sure if it really is, but that was my bet. I bet 7K. He called, and I tabled my eights, and he tabled pocket nines.
Right. So nines, it was one hand I was a little bit worried about just because it's right there in between the 10 and the 8. He just got you pipped barely. I don't know. I mean, you kind of value owned yourself a little bit, but you know, I don't hate it because if he can call you with nines, maybe he can call you with sevens, sixes, fives, and fours, right? There's not that much difference. There's a little bit of difference, obviously, but You know, it's just, yeah, I don't know. That's odd. I mean, I think it's odd that he doesn't bet the flop. I think it's odd that he doesn't bet at any point. I mean, it's a very good flop for pocket nines. Mm-hmm. 10, yeah. Deuce, deuce. He's lucky that you had a hand that had perceived value. Otherwise, he doesn't get any value for his nines, right? Now, would you have kept betting if you had pocket fours? I don't think so.
Well, if I have fours, I have almost no value.
Right, then you can't get caught by anything worse.
Yeah,
right. So he's kind of lucky you had that exact pair,
pretty much.
That you could do the betting for him. But yeah, I don't know. I still feel like the river bet's a little ambitious. I know I didn't mention nine specifically. They were a little bit in the back of my mind, but sure. You know, it's like if he can have sevens, he can have nines. I think it's odd the way he played the whole hand. So, yeah, I think if I'm the one with nines, it comes 10, deuce, deuce, and some guy named Mark is two to my left, I'm going to c-bet that every time.
Okay. You
know? And if Mark bets again on the turn, I don't know. I would probably be a little scared that my pocket nines were no good against this amateur opponent. I don't know. I mean, yeah, it's a tough one. It's a tough one for him because he made it tough on himself. You had the only hand, I think, that's going to keep betting and that he can beat.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I brought this hand is because I thought there was a lot of discussion to be had because it's a really strange one. And maybe I did get too ambitious. I showed this hand to Jonathan Little, who I worked with before, and he thought that it was actually pretty reasonable. I talked to Alec, and he said, you know, Alec thought that most river cards would be a check in my position, but that river card was simply too good. It almost eliminated, you know, it really cut down on the number of 10x combinations. It didn't complete any draws. It was way too, almost, I guess, static of a river card. Like, the board almost never changed. And eights are pretty good on 10 deuce deuce, and they're basically just as good on 10-10 deuce deuce 3 with no flush. So it's, we talked about it for a while because, you know, you've played enough main events. At the end of day one, there's so many tables that it takes them 10 minutes to get around with the bags, and you just sort of hang out there. And I talked to him for a while about this hand, and he thought it was totally reasonable. He might have just been telling me that, but we were never going to play again. Like, the day was over. So I think he was being honest, if I had to guess. And he thought it was reasonable. I mean, a little aggressive, ambitious, but there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I was going for value. I got value owned. I mean, I've been assured by Bart Hansen that that's what you're supposed to be doing at least some of the time. Is if you're never value owning yourself, you're not getting enough value.
Yeah, so, I mean, I would never beat yourself up because you value owned yourself. I mean, I think the more common mistake is that people don't get enough thin value and that they have a win percentage at showdown that is just way too high.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you feeling like there's a good chance your eights are good, knowing that 10 didn't really change anything, no flushes came in, that you can, you know, effectively represent a busted flush draw and then get calls from hands like sevens, sixes, fives, and fours, and not the one pocket pair that you think he can have that actually does beat you. I mean, when you add all that up, it is a bet again. But yeah, I was scared, maybe needlessly so, that he didn't see bet such a good flop. I mean, I would see bet that flop with probably close to 100% of my range versus you.
Sure.
Maybe versus Alec himself or, you know, some other professional. You have to, you know, kind of disguise things more, be more careful. But yeah, in his shoes, I'm surprised that he played the whole hand so passively. He ended up getting maximum value in doing so, but it's still surprising that that's the line he took. But, you know, it does make sense when you think about it. I mean, he has to have a, you know, as you said earlier, protect his checking range. And he knows you could have a 10. He knows you could even have a deuce, right? Who's to say you don't have ace, deuce suited in your calling range? Like, there's a lot of hands that beat him, but there's so many that he can beat, including all of those busted flush draws you already referenced, that he has to call with nines when you bet half the pot on the end. I wonder whether he can call with nines if you bomb the river. You know,
possibly.
Does he call with nines if you bet the pot or more?
I'm not sure. I mean, I would expect to be able to pull off an overbet bluff against someone who's less experienced, but I wasn't going to try something like that with him.
Right.
So I was genuinely going for value. I thought he had 2 sevens or 2 sixes, and I was going for it. I decided I wasn't going to back down, and you know, I mean, sometimes you lose when you go for it, but I thought it was reasonable at the time.
Yeah. Well, I give you a lot of credit because I think you had, you know, good strong sense of logic about the hand from the beginning. You felt like you knew where you stood, and your read was my eights are good. And you know, one thing that I try to teach the people that I coach is if you have a read and you have logic to back up your read, follow your read and play accordingly. You know, if you tell me he paid you off with sevens, does that mean that you, like, in reality you value owned yourself, but in that alternate universe where he pays you off with sevens, is it just nice hand, Mark? You know,
exactly.
You can't have it both ways.
I mean, is it a mistake if he has nines, and is it a brilliant play if he has sevens?
Right.
Some people would 100% tell you yes. I believe the bet was good. I think he would call me with sevens or sixes or fives. Like, I think he would. I don't know. We'll never know.
Yeah.
But I stand by it. Maybe it was a bit too ambitious, especially for the main, but I was trying to build a stack for day two. Like, if I win this pot, if he has sevens and he calls on the end, I'm going to have like 100K going into day two. But instead I had 53, and that's how it goes.
And having 53 heading into day two is more than enough.
That's fine. Yeah.
You know, it's totally fine. The main event is a very different animal. For those who have never played it and you've never fulfilled your own personal bucket list wish, as Mark did this summer, believe me, going into day two with a few fewer chips than you started day one with is normally a disaster in almost any tournament you play in the world. But the main event, you're totally fine. You show up with 40K on day two, you're totally fine. So it's not the end of the world. Anyway, one thing I always like to ask people before we say goodbye to you, do you want them to follow you on Twitter? Do you Twitch yourself? Can we see you in the TP Discord? Like, if people want to learn more about Mark Lovin, how can they do that?
So I think it's called X now, but I think we're going to be calling it Twitter for a long time.
right.
Yeah, I am at Mark C. Lovin. I have like maybe a dozen followers, just really just friends and family. When I go to Vegas or something, I post, you know, pictures of food, pictures of chip stacks, whatever. But, and you know, feel free to send me a message, tell me I'm terrible, or ask me a question about the hand or whatever. Be happy to talk on about Twitter. It's just at MarkC11. As far as recommending something for people, go check out Killing Bird Stream. It's a ton of fun. That's where I kind of got involved and met the community and very much enjoy. It's Tuesday nights at 9. It's his home game, and I highly recommend people who have not tried it, come check out the stream with Derek, and it's a good time.
Absolutely. I get in there as much as I can. The Killing Bird home game every Tuesday, 9 p.m. Eastern. We also have the TPE free roll, which is back on ACR every Sunday at 6 p.m. now, which is a new time compared with last year and earlier this year when we were doing the free rolls. We did pause them during the WSOP, but we're now back with a weekly free roll, $1,000 in free money being given away every single Sunday, courtesy of ACR Poker. Mark Lovin, thank you so much for being an excellent first-time guest here on the podcast.
It was a privilege. Thank you for having me.
Of course. And so for Mark Lovin and for everyone here at TPE, with special thanks, as always, to our very generous sponsor, ACR Poker, I'm Clayton Fletcher. Thank you so much for listening.
I wanna hold them like they do in Texas, please. Fold them, let them hit me, raise it, baby, stay with me. Luck and intuition, play the cards with babes to start. And after she's been hooked, I'll play the one that's on her heart. Yeah.
she can't read my poker face. She's got to love nobody.